Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Kevin O'Malley, Vice Chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum at the Commonwealth Club, and your chairman for this evening. Tonight's event is co-presented by Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Clubs by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. I'd like to introduce our moderator for tonight, Christy Dames of Tech Talk Studio. Christy has a long involvement with creating partnerships across business, nonprofit, and educational boundaries, including a wonderful pilot project called San Francisco Shine, featured on CNN, where she brought together San Francisco business, government, and nonprofits to hire homeless people to clean up the downtown area and reach out to visitors in our city, which became the model for the current business improvement district. Please welcome Christy to the stage as she kicks off tonight's program.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program. We are pleased to host four business leaders, pioneers, and entrepreneurs who have at the heart of their capitalist endeavors our environment. Our topic for tonight is green capital, profit, and the planet. I'd like to introduce our four panelists. First at the far end is Steve Panetti. He's a senior vice president of Kimpton Hotels, which manages 46 hotels and 46 restaurants across the U.S. and Canada, with over $500 million in annual revenue. Steve is the driving force behind Kimpton's highly successful green initiative, which has both made a significant contribution to the environment and greatly increased their profits, customer satisfaction, and employee loyalty. Kimpton Hotels began their green push in 1984, long before businesses were even thinking green. Next to Steve is Will Rogers. He's the president the Trust for Public Land, a leading national nonprofit that conserves land as parks, playgrounds, historic places, and wilderness. Based in San Francisco, TPL has 450 staff and 40 offices nationwide. And since 1972, TPL has helped protect over 2 million acres of land. Under Will's leadership, TPL's conservation finance program has helped 295 states and communities design and pass ballot measures that have created over $25 billion in land conservation funding through bonds and sales taxes to protect air and water quality, preserve land, and create parks. Next is Hunter Lovins, who perhaps needs no introduction at all. She is the co-founder of the Rocky Mountain Institute and founder and president of Natural Capitalism Solutions. Hunter consults with the Pentagon, the EPA, Royal Dutch Shell, among many others, on issues of climate and sustainability, and is an advisor to the Energy Minister of Afghanistan. In 2000, Hunter was recognized as Time Magazine's Hero of the Planet and is the co-author of 9 books, including the highly influential Natural Capitalism. And last but certainly not least is Peter Liu. He was just featured in Time Magazine's Global Warming issue last week. He is the initial founder and vice chairman of the New Resource Bank, the nation's first and only commercial green bank, already with over $60 million in assets in just 6 months. As an energy banker at Credit Suisse First Boston and the Chase Manhattan Bank, Peter completed over $8 billion in energy project financings. Peter has brought together a who's who of investors to the New Resource Bank, including Bob and Bill Hambrecht, Daniel Johannes, U.S. Bank's former vice chair, and the founders of Sybase and Lotus Development. On that, we're going to start the questions, and we're going to go right into some Q&A, and then a little bit later on, we're going to have audience Q&A as well. I'd like to start with you, Steve. If you could tell us a little bit about the challenges that you faced so early on in launching your green program, since it's been around for such a long time.
Sure. When Christy talks about a program at Kimpton Hotels, what we've got going right now is over the last 3-4 years, we've rolled out about 44 different operational practices in our hotels. Probably everybody here is somewhat familiar with what most hotel companies do, around. If you hang your towels, they don't get washed, or if you make up your pillow, then the sheets don't get washed, and you can save energy. But that kind of isn't really what it's about. That really saves money, doesn't really help save the planet. Some of the things that we've got going is everything from organic coffees and teas. The soaps and shampoos are all organic. The cleaning supplies that our folks use to clean the house, clean the hotels, whether it's the carpet, the air, or any of the fabrics, are all organic. One of our employees came up with a great idea, recycling the clothes hangers, that the laundry comes back. All in all, there's about 44, 46 different things going on in our hotels and restaurants. When we first started the program, we started out with, oh, look at all the things we could do. We could save money here. We could recycle out the back end. And the list got really big, really quick. And so it got very clear early on that the goal was not to try to do too much too fast and really think it through. Again, I can't afford to compromise the guest experience. Some of our hotels here in San Francisco include the Argonaut down at Fisherman's Wharf, the Monaco, the Palomar, the Prescott, the Triton, and so on. And so we wanted to be green. We wanted to do our part. We wanted to support, but we were not in a position where we could afford to compromise the guest experience. If that were to happen and we fail, then the kind of financial support we get from the business standpoint would diminish, and thus we would see our whole effort diminish. So we wanted to do it. It had the same, things like cleaning supplies needed to cost the same or less, or we weren't going to just do green for the sake of green. So we were kind of at the beginning trying to juggle between what can we do, what is the business model, how does it affect our guest, and then how do we get our employees involved. One of the first things we did is we hired an outside consultant, and I'd like to recognize him if he's here. Jeff, are you here? Jeff Sly from Business Evolution Consulting. It was clear that this program was going to be so big, yet it was something that was going to be a permanent part of our cultural DNA. We hired an outside resource to come in and really run it for us. It wasn't something any one of us could do, take on as a committee or a project. It was too big and too inclusive. The other thing was a very extensive communication process. I've got over 8,500 employees, so it was really important that everybody in the company knew what we were doing and why we were doing it and what their individual role in this whole effort was on a day-to-day basis. And it took us the better part of 6 months to really identify the program and then ultimately roll it out in a way that our people could understand it and in six different languages and on and on. So there was about a year's worth of brain damage, really, in getting this thing understood, under control, into a business plan, and then ultimately rolled out. The one thing that we did that was really kind of cool that really gave the program traction is we sent out a note to all of the hotels and restaurants, and we asked for a volunteer or two in each business, an eco-champion, if you will, because the way these programs need to live is not pushed down from home office. We can kind of come up with the idea, provide the support and the know-how and the training, but if a program is going to live in a business, it needs to be something that is embraced by the employees and is organic from the employee base up. And so we established one or two champions in each hotel and restaurant. And these weren't just management people. These were the people in the businesses that were the most passionate about wanting to see this program succeed, something that was of value to them in their own personal world. And now they had an opportunity to bring that passion into their workplace. And I think that was probably the single thread that sort of held all of our hotels and restaurants around the country together, kind of the internal glue, if you will, and giving Jeff a platform on which to ultimately build. Finding vendors was incredible because, you know, you start talking about going green and the first thing you hear is, well, it's going to cost too much money and it's going to take too much time and generally it can't be done. So we went through all that. And it took 1 year for us to find a supplier for the cleaning supplies that our room cleaners use to clean a room to test. Because the other problem I had was if it doesn't foam, my room cleaners don't think it's cleaning. So a lot of organic stuff doesn't foam. So then we had to stop in our tracks and go through that. The other thing we found out is that one of these, a lot of the products that we were using, when they're mixed to water, there are 18 different levels of water density around the country, and so what works on a ratio here is not going to work anywhere else, as we found out. And we were at that point using three different regional vendors to provide these cleaning supplies, who then had to send their people out to visit each business to balance the amount of product with the amount of water based on the density of water. I'm only talking about one product now. We rolled out 44. It took us a year just to figure out the cleaning angle.
All right.
So it's a big deal. At the end of it all, it's been 3 years. We've got 44 products up and running, and it's pretty successful.
You mentioned you were talking about thinking, having to think it through. And Peter, I'd like to ask you what you've just done and the endeavor you've undertaken. What signs did you see that told you that now was the time for a sustainable green bank?
Yeah, I think a bank is in some ways a reflection of its community. So really, the community asked for this bank. There were green businesses that were out there. Everybody gets banked. Everybody has a bank, but the banks didn't understand their business quite as well. Didn't take a customized or a knowledgeable approach to help them grow. So that's what we're here to do. And there's also lots of people. I might want to take a poll, but that might be too controversial. Who are just not satisfied with their current bank. Banking is a surprisingly low, industry in terms of customer satisfaction, about less than 38%. So combine those two facts. We set out to do three things. One is to set a new standard customer service. As a new bank, we have to do better. Second is to finance sustainable resources in our community. That's to help green businesses, as I mentioned. It's also to work with every community members in terms of taking the green to them. There are builders out there that we work with. They're conventional builders. They've been hearing about green, and they have their suspicions. So what we do is to introduce them to conferences, seminars, to other partners to show them how green can be beautiful, green can be strong, and green can be more marketable. So we're actually being able to take people who are not green and turning them onto green. And lastly, again, the ubiquity of banking is that, again, everybody banks. Everybody has to, unless you want to stuff your money underneath your mattress, you probably have it in a bank. So we understand that if we roll this out, everybody in our community is a potential customer. So those were the signs and the opportunity.
Hunter, I'd like to ask you, because everybody here is involved with sustainable and natural capitalism, can you give us your definition of what natural capitalism is?
Sure. Natural capitalism is a way of doing business that is more profitable than the way business is conventionally done, and that also solves most of the environmental and many of the social problems facing us. It has three basic principles. First, buy time. We are faced with enormous challenges like climate change, perhaps peak oil, the loss of every major ecosystem on the planet. What we most need is time, and the best way we can buy that is by using resources dramatically more productively. And doing this is profitable right now. It's one of the reasons that Walmart has gotten into this green game. They found they can make money by cutting waste. Second, we're going to need to redesign every product and process in society. That's a big task. That's one of the reasons we need to buy a little time. But we have approaches like biomimicry or Walter Stahel's Cradle to Cradle to help inform us in doing this. And it will be an enormous business opportunity. Think about rebuilding everything to do business the way that nature does, with no waste, running on sunlight, shopping locally, manufacturing near to something that's alive. These are the basic principles by which nature makes its products and services. Third, we will manage all institutions to be restorative of human and natural capital, the two forms of capital that are in short supply now in our world. We're losing intact culture, and we're losing every major ecosystem. So by doing business in ways that enhance those forms of capital, we're actually just being good capitalists. the way we practice capital now isn't wrong because it's capitalism. It's wrong because it's violating its own internal logic. We're liquidating the forms of capital that can enhance wealth and well-being around the planet. So that's natural capitalism.
Building on what Hunter said, that was great. Building on what Hunter said and also what Peter said, we're talking, the build word is coming up. And so we're talking about building and supply chains and building and land and resources. Will, I'd like to ask you, are you actually an environmental organization or are you a developer? Or are you both?
We're an undeveloper. Or you could say we are a developer of green infrastructure. And it's interesting because we, to some extent, sit on the other side of an increasingly blurry line between the for-profit and the not-for-profit sectors. And that blurring of the line is really exciting to me. To the tune of about $500 million a year of real estate deals in the marketplace, we are working to protect natural capital directly. Our shareholders are the American public. Our product is are the places that people care about, or livable cities, lovable cities, if you will. And the goal is to help people make the connection with the natural world that will give them the respect for that natural capital and hopefully lead to a more sustainable society. We work with two bottom lines. Our primary bottom line is around the mission of protecting land for people from inner city to wilderness. And we do it through planning. We do it through helping communities raise money to protect land. We do it through deals. We do it in the marketplace, which makes us an unusual nonprofit. But at the same time, we got to make the numbers work, or at the end of the day, we're not in business. And the better we can make the numbers work, the more resources we have to help other people protect the places they care about. And what excites me and interests me about the movement in corporate America and social responsibility is that the for-profit side are adopting that dual bottom line as well. And that's a great trend.
Well, since TPL has been around such a long time, and now we have the attention of people out there, it's the green is on mainstream, as Thomas Friedman just wrote in the New York Times this weekend. Are you having to change your strategy? Are you having to rethink things? Do you have a brand new big playing field now that's opening up?
Well, I mean, I think we have a diminishing playing field to some extent. I mean, time is running short. The pressures on our landscapes are enormous. We've got to make our cities work, because if our cities don't work, the pressure on the land outside of our cities is increasing. The opportunities are certainly there. Is it a fad? Is it another moment of media attention, or is it a real fundamental change in society? So our strategy is to continue to do what we've always done. Our portfolio is likely to change. There's absolutely a nexus, for example, between climate change, which is really fueling this green interest. The evidence is undeniable now at this point. And so I think that's what's really tipped things. And the nexus between land conservation and creating livable cities and protecting habitat corridors defensively, so that if things do have to migrate and adapt, they have the place to do that. Reforestation, avoiding deforestation, all of those are parts of our portfolio that we will probably change strategically to be responsive to what's going on out there. But first and foremost, we focus on the relationship between people and land, because we believe that if people don't have a relationship with nature, that the fuel, the power behind the green movement ain't going to be there.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned fad, which is interesting. And Hunter, I've heard you say things in the past about environmentalist, we've won. And I've also heard you say this cannot be a fear-based type of program that we push through to the American people. Can you comment a little bit on that? Is fear driving this new change? What's moving this so rapidly?
No, actually, I think the recognition of the role of the business world in saving the world. You can work yourself up into a fair state of fear if you read the papers on a regular basis. But that's not a good way to try to solve problems. And what the business community is very good about is innovating and problem solving, bringing new products to market, and making a buck doing that. So I think that's what we're seeing now. At the same time, we have an interesting driver of change that I'm calling the sustainability imperative. 3 weeks ago, I was briefing the entire senior management of Walmart. Walmart has pledged to become climate neutral, 100% renewable energy, world's largest organic retailer. Why are they doing this? Because they don't have a choice. Because their competitors, Costco and Target, have been going green and taking market share. And in the 4 years since Lee Scott took over, Walmart stock fell 30%. So they're in a fight for their lives. And indeed, the companies that you see here that have been doing this for a while, that are creating new organizations, are in part in response to this imperative on business. Of the Fortune 500 in 1985, half of them aren't here anymore. There's nothing that says a company has to hang around. And the companies, the billionaires of tomorrow, will be those who get this green right both ways. In fact, I think we're talking about what is it that enhances shareholder value. If Milton Friedman is correct that the responsibility of a company is to its shareholders, what is shareholder value? Sure, it's profit. That's the one P of what has been called the triple bottom line: people, profit, planet. But if you simply bolt the other two on as cost centers, in tough times, what's a businessman going to default to? You heard it. It's got to be profitable. An integrated bottom line asks what constitutes value for the owner. And it comes from profit. It also comes from reduction of risk. So if the banking industry of late, J.P. Morgan Chase, just started indexing its bonds to whether or not their company has taken their carbon footprint seriously. Swiss Re, the big European reinsurer, is saying to its customers, if you don't take your carbon footprint seriously, maybe we don't want to insure you. The automakers have been sued because of their carbon footprint. So these unbooked liabilities, the reduction of risk, is a very important component to shareholder value that the green companies are capturing, the brown companies aren't yet. The ability to get and keep the best people. The companies that announce a commitment to aggressive climate protection are the most exciting places to go and work. Increase labor productivity, build good green buildings, and you can get as much as 16% higher labor productivity. Driving innovation. When ST Microelectronics announced that it was going to become carbon neutral with a 40-fold increase in production by 2010, they had no clue how to do it. Figuring it out has taken them from the number 12 chip maker in the world to the number 6. They're increasing their market share and driving their innovation. You just go through and ask, what constitutes shareholder value? And a commitment to behaving responsibly to people and planet enhances every aspect. That's what we're calling the integrated bottom line. And it is, I think, the reason that you will see this more and more and more.
I might have just one more thing to add on fad versus trend, a long-term trend, which is really the performance of the alternatives. If my Prius drove like a Yugo, it will be a fad. And also, if you look at organic, not too many people will call it a fad anymore. It certainly was when it came out into the marketplace maybe 20 years ago. But it took a whole sort of community of innovators. If you took your vegetables, organic vegetables, and you boil it to death, it wouldn't make a difference in terms of taste or differentiation. But if you're like Alice Waters and you cook with the freshest ingredients and you take ingredients that's been grown with care and that's in harmonious with the earth, it comes through in the taste. So the products, ultimately, driven by the entrepreneurs, when it reaches a level of quality, just like Kimpton Hotels, I mean, I stayed there, and it's not. I think Steve is actually too modest. I mean, the experience is not just comparable; it's actually better than many hotels that I've stayed at. So that the fact that it's better and it's green, it's going to continue to drive this trend.
Well, good. Steve, let's go over to you, because you have mentioned in the past about making money and saving money, and that there is, because sure. You're green, there's an enormous amount of making money and saving money that's happened for Kimpton. So if you could talk about that and also about the survey that you just did
sure.
of your guests.
Yeah, it kind of ties back into what Hunter was saying. I've got
I've got three folks I got to take care of. I've got my investors, I've got my employees, and I've got my guests. One of the cool things we did that brought our program alive for the guests, because a lot of what we do is behind the scenes, white light bulbs and paint and things like that. But the thing we did that was cool is we put a recycle can in each guest room. And now the guests, not only were they very aware of what we were doing, started asking questions, which is what triggered me educating all the staff in six languages. But it gave the guest an opportunity to participate in a program that they share a value around. And this is the thing that we're uncovering. It's not just our guests, but I think people in general are they're wanting to do business with folks who share the same values. And I ran a survey. We're really good at trying to figure out where the business comes from and who they are and why they're there and all that stuff. And we surveyed about 5,000 first-time guests and asked the question, why are you here? How'd you hear? Why are you here? 16% of the people said, I'm specifically at your hotel because of your environmental program. So you can extract. I'm running another survey right now because I'm getting about as much mileage out of that statistic as I can, and I got to collaborate it. But you take a $500 million company and you extrapolate 16% of that, it's a fairly serious situation. A great story is we had a little blurb appear in a Chicago paper about three of our hotels won an EPA award in Chicago, of all places, for the work that they were doing. Those three hotels, that day that that article appeared, got something like five or six calls from companies locally that said, I've never done business with your hotels, but I'm under a mandate at my company to put my meetings and my business in hotels and fly on airlines and rent cars that share the same values. And although we've never done business with you guys before, do you have meeting space, on and on. That little article booked almost $1 million in business for those little hotels just in that first week that thing appeared. My own partner, we haven't said it yet, but Kempton and TPL, we actually partner and we do a lot of things together. I help these folks raise money because one of their programs is what's called Parks for People. And they go into urban areas and they buy up old buildings or they take over vacant lots and they create parks in downtown areas. The premise being every child in America should have an opportunity to play in a park or go to a rec center. In return, they're one of my biggest accounts, and they put a lot of money into all of my hotels and restaurants. So it's an opportunity how was that? Was that good?
Yeah, that was good.
We have an opportunity to work together. So from the public standpoint, it's a pretty cool thing. Internally, saving money, the one big thing we did when we first rolled out the program was we started recycling all of our trash out of the back end of the hotel and the restaurant. And that saved all of our hotels right off the bat about $2,500 to $4,500 a month just in recycling the trash, let alone the water savings, let alone, you know, and I've got water filters in all of my showers, but what people don't realize is you can go in and adjust those filters. If you have something like 25 gallons of water flowing out of your shower, which is a good strong shower, which is when people are traveling or staying in a nice hotel, they want a hard shower. Well, you put in the restrictor and that knocks it down to 14. Well, you can go in and mess around with that restrictor and maybe you ratchet it back up to 19. So I'm saving some water. I'm still giving a good product. The customer's participating. I'm saving money. Everything's happy. But to Hunter's point, at the end of the day, if my businesses don't make money, if I'm not profitable, and we're a performance, we're in the business of making money, I can't do all these cool things that I'm doing. And one of the things that's really great, for those of you that know Kempton Hotels, we grew up here in San Francisco, and we've done everything from our green program to our goldfish program to our pet-friendly to you name it. We've even got beds for really tall people like Will so their feet don't hang off the end. And we're the only hotel folks out there doing stuff like that. One of the things that we know is that every hotel company in the country watches what we do and has copied just about everything that we do. And so we're not going to save the planet by all the little things that we're doing, but we are making a difference in our own way, and we are motivating our own employees. And our hope is that the other folks who copy us for everything else will copy what we're doing now. You know, and certainly the guys at Starwood who have more money than God, and they'll let you know about all the things that they're doing, are going to come out with a lot of stuff, making it sound like you know, they're going to save the planet. Well, at the end of the day, anybody does anything, it's a great thing. And as much money as they want to put behind promoting it, it's a good thing. But I know that one of the reasons they're doing it is their director of marketing used to work for us, and he's always watching. He's always watching what we do, and I know we had an influence in what you're about to read coming out. A fun last story about the effect on our employees. I was in Washington, D.C., and one of the housemen, the guys that keep the house clean, he's like, you know, this environmental program, it's killing me. He's like, I said, what are you talking about? How's that? He's like, oh, you know, we had a big family function at the hotel. So my wife comes down to the hotel. She sees all these recycled bins all over the place and says, we ought to be recycling at home. You know, you're doing that at work. So he's like, every Tuesday, I got to put out the bag. It's got all my beer bottles and water and wine bottles. So now she's seeing how much me and my friends are partying at the house. It's like, so there's good and bad, I guess, with all that.
Hunter, I want to ask you, I've also heard you say that businesses and executives know. I mean, they know there's a problem. We now know. But you said the biggest problem is, now that we know, what do we do? What do we do now? How do you help? What are the top three things that you're going to say to an executive who just doesn't know what to do?
This is an interesting challenge. My company, Natural Capitalism Solution, is now getting called by a lot of the suppliers to Walmart saying, we just got this environmental scorecard that Walmart wants us to fill out. Walmart has, by the way, 90,000 suppliers. Wow. What do we do? There are a number of places to start. We advise a company to start quietly internally, looking at their own operations and looking for opportunities to cut cost and save money, to understand what it is that they want to go forward with before they start talking about it. You take a company like a General Electric coming out and announcing Eco-Imagination. They're great at their marketing. You look at their actual operations, and they're kind of back at the exploration stage. If they stay there very long, that's a pretty good definition of greenwashing. But there are opportunities in every aspect of a business, whether it be in the operations, whether it be in the human relations, whether it be in communications, in R&D, and by systematically looking throughout a company's activity streams, they will begin to find these opportunities. They can then kick the tires. Go try it. Try a little eco-efficiency. Change your light bulbs. Just changing out
right.
These light bulbs would save the Commonwealth Club some money. And sitting down and talking with a consultant who has been around this bush a time or two and can help you find the really cost-effective opportunities. If you're a little business on Main Street, what do? My company is also in the process of writing a manual for small to medium-sized businesses on how to protect the climate in ways that save them money. You can go on my website. There is a paper called The Business Case for Climate Protection, which you can download for free. And it'll begin to give you examples of things that you can do to save money in your own operations. The most important thing, though, is to start. It really doesn't matter if it feels like only one little thing. We got it. The problems that are facing us were caused by all of us doing the little things that added up. It's all the little things that each of us can do in our lives that can then add up. And for each of you who are here, here's one thing that you can do. Go on the web tonight, driveneutral.org. It allows you to calculate the carbon emitted by your car. Pay roughly the cost of a couple fill-ups of gas, and your car will be carbon neutral for a year. This is a program that was created by my students at Presidio School of Management. The money goes to Chicago Climate Exchange, which works with companies to help them figure out ways to offset their carbon emissions and save money at it. There are now over 200 companies trading carbon in this country, even though there's no law that says that you have to. And indeed, there are now whole states. The state of New Mexico is a member. Cities, Berkeley's a member. My city of Boulder is a member. Universities, my college is a member. So if any of you have a business and you're looking for something to do, consider joining Chicago Climate Exchange.
That's great. Will and Peter, we're talking about where are we going to put our money? Look at your organizations. I know if I put my money into New Resource Bank, I know it's going to fund a green, it's going to fund something green. So I'm feeling pretty confident. And I know that with your organization, your large reach, that it's going to go to something really powerful. So as one individual who might be overwhelmed, I don't know where to begin. Can you talk a little bit about the individual, but also for an executive that's running a billion-dollar corporation, where do they begin to?
Well, I mean, obviously the place to begin is with the Trust for Public Land. But the, to some extent, I think you have to begin with where your heart is. And I think you have to know what the options are. And I think what we're talking about here, we're talking about climate change, we're talking about conservation, we could be talking about affordable housing, we could be talking about a host of social services or transit. I mean, there is a holistic set of solutions that really matter. And taken together, it's called sustainability. And every, you know, you pull on a thread and the fabric that you're pulling on is sustainability. And one could argue that if you don't address the full fabric of sustainability, you're not going to get to solutions with any one of these issues. And so I think it's very much a function of what industry you're in, what your passion is. I work with an organization of 450 wonderful employees, and we have 600 volunteers, and they are all incredibly passionate about place. They care about nature, they care about place, and that's where they're putting their energies and their efforts, and the donors who support us feel the same way. But I think you have to really identify for yourself what it is that matters to you and then do something about it. And it means both in action and with your wallet and in every other way that you can think of. In terms of what my advice to people who are managing organizations that are dealing with these issues, I think there's nothing more compelling for employees and for the public, you know, your brand and your people, than having a compelling mission. And that is about the multiple bottom line. It isn't just about money. It's about having a statement, a vision, a mission that really relates to making the planet a better place and dealing with sustainability. And that gives you loyalty both inside your organization and outside your organization. And so it's one more element of success that comes with green.
Peter, right, just before you answer, we're going to be heading into the Q&A portion of tonight's program in just a few minutes. So if you have any questions, please line up over here at the mic, and we'll start taking questions in a few minutes. For the radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club's Green Capital Program. And tonight we're talking with business pioneers on the front lines of the sustainable movement. I'm Christy Dames of Tech Talk Studio, and I'm here with Peter Liu, initial founder and chairman of the New Resource Bank, Hunter Lovins, the president of Natural Capitalism Solutions, Steve Panetti, senior vice president of Kimpton Hotels, and Will Rogers, the president of Trust for Public Land. Peter, did you want to?
Sure, yeah. I think for business executives, start today is my advice. If we go back maybe 10, 20 years, looking at the automotive industry, there were people looking at the issue of perhaps dwindling oil supply or higher fuel prices. Some people took an innovative approach to say we're going to produce a car maybe by tomorrow that's going or to start working on a car today that will be there tomorrow that can be more fuel efficient. They're called hybrids. There are others who keep shifting that off using maybe other means to say we can always do it 10 years from now. That 10 years keeps shifting. And unfortunately today, those that said let's look in the future are laying people off today. And those who looked at it and say, we'll start today, are thriving. So it starts with today. And for everyday people, I would say it starts with the everyday, that don't think that this is the big task. Again, I'm going to give ourselves a plug here. You can start with just your banking. Every day, everybody has to do that. But you can also start with your light bulbs. And it doesn't have to be something that fundamentally changes your life. It starts with something that you do every day in your life.
And Peter, one other question. You were talking recently when you were in Time magazine, you were also talking about thinking big and taking New Resource Bank across the country. Can you comment on that as well?
Yeah, again, our approach is always we go where our community of people wants us to be. If you go to, when we look at it, the most frequently asked questions in our website is, when will New Resource Bank come to our community? And even as a small bank with one branch in San Francisco, we already have customers from as far as London, Paris, New York, Virginia, Tennessee, Texas, Missouri, Illinois, Wisconsin, the Northwest, of course, the core here in the Bay Area, and Southern California. So in some ways, we are reflecting what Thomas Friedman has been saying, because I see both red and blue states represented there. So green is indeed becoming the new red, white, and blue.
All right. Thank you. We have a question from the audience.
Yes, thank you. My name is Joseph Malky. I'm with Seven Star, America's largest event producers. And one of the questions that we are dealing with right now, as we are receiving calls from all over the planet, it's regarding capacity building in terms of three things. First of all, raw materials. When it comes to certification of foreign organic products such as cotton, wood, in terms of FSC certification, we're having a problem with the actual demand for raw goods. Secondly, we're having a problem with mid-cap companies desperately in need of green consultants, and there are very, very few. So I'd like the panel to perhaps address those two factors. First of all, how are we going to control not just commodities brokers and hedge funds from dominating and interfering with the price points that we need to get in order to get green couches into JCPenney's, for example, and at the same time, how are we going to get more green consultants on the ground to these mid-cap companies so they can do the right thing?
Okay.
Well, I'll jump in on an answer to the second one. You tell me the companies and I'll get you the consultants. We are graduating roughly 50 students a semester from Presidio School of Management. This is the first MBA program in which sustainability is woven throughout every aspect of the curriculum. It's right here in San Francisco, and we've got graduates ready to go.
On the FSC timber, the news is good. We do a lot of conservation easements with timber companies, organizations like Plum Creek, where we negotiate both public access but also FSC management. And so I, just based on our experience, I would say that the awareness and the appreciation for sustainable harvesting practices has gone through the ceiling. That should be showing up sometime soon.
Yeah, you know, our biggest challenge in these new hotels that we're either building or in the adaptive reuse of an old building, our biggest challenge is really in the construction and design. And we have run into the problem there where finding general contractors that can do it at a reasonable price relative to the returns that we have to generate is it's really difficult. It's not impossible. It's slowly coming around, but it's very tough. And the same thing with the furnishings and the fixtures. They're either custom and they're too expensive, or they're mass produced and they're not, you know, they're not the right style or quality. We've got four hotels. We have 10 hotels under construction right now. Four of them are one I think is going to actually be fully LEED certified. We're on that trail, so hopefully that won't get compromised. And we have three others. And even if we can't get it fully LEED certified, we'll do what little bit we can, whether it's the plumbing or the wiring. What's so incredible is that you can build an entire building out of recycled materials. You just got to put in the effort to search through it. That's kind of the big challenge that faces us right now in our world. We try as much as we can to use an old building, kind of the inherent energy. The Argonaut Hotel down at Fisherman's Wharf, the old Del Monte warehouse, as what that used to be back in its old days about 150 years ago. We could take an old building like that, bring it back. It saves an incredible amount of time and money and waste in retrofitting something like that than just tearing it down and starting all over. So when we can, we try to, where they're reclaiming and reusing land, we're trying to do the same with buildings.
And clearly one of the reasons we have a relationship is because we're, you know, we're in the preservation business, they are too, and because we like the showers.
See?
Go ahead.
Thank you. Hi, I have a question for Steve. Hi, Steve. My name is Paul Liotsakis, and I run a program here with a local nonprofit called San Francisco Community Power, and we have a program called Demand Response. that helps organizations reduce energy use whenever there's a peak grid emergency to help avoid rolling blackouts and also the most polluting power plants from coming on. And recently we contacted your hotels, and we were hoping you guys would get on board. And I know that there were some internal reasons why you didn't participate. I'm not sure if you know why, but I have some creative ideas. I've been a guest plenty of times. So I was wondering,
turn around and meet Jeff Sly, who's the man who runs the whole program for us, and he's the guy who can make it happen if it's something that should happen.
Great.
All right.
Perfect. Sir. That works.
I dodged that pretty.
If I can put in a word for.
I'm serious. Jeff runs our program, and if it's worthy, it's something we should do. It'll happen.
If I can put in a word for this, this is the sort of program that any business person can do. Get with one of the local energy consultants and figure out how to drop your load at the point at which the system would otherwise have a peak. It's good for your business. It's real good for the rest of the community.
Okay. Yeah, I have a question about the politics of all of this. And I keep encountering people who seem to think that the environmental movement or the whole concept of sustainability is a plot hatched by a bunch of liberals to achieve greater government control over our lives. And so how much of a political, in terms of public opinion and sort of grassroots politics, how much resistance is there still to the idea that we should be making greater and more successful efforts in helping the environment?
Let me give one example that addresses that from our viewpoint. Since 94, we've worked with states, counties, municipalities to help create about, I don't know, $25, $27 billion worth of public funding. The places that choose to tax themselves, where people choose to go into the voting booth and say, yep, I'm going to tax myself to protect something I care about, are not just the liberal bastions in this country. This is something that completely cuts across America. And we see when one of these initiatives goes onto a ballot, 80% of the time it passes. And that's an extraordinary record. And this is in red states, blue states. It's in the Rust Belt, the Sun Belt. It's with every demographic, you name it. And people are voting to tax themselves to protect the places they care about. And this is above politics. And to me, that's just one indicator. And I know you all have other ones. But we've seen this for years. And so it's more avoiding the conversation that triggers that resistance in really talking to people about values and what they care about, you get to a place where everyone is on the same page very quickly.
I wear a little button on my hat, 25 by 25. That's 25% renewable energy by 2025. It's a Republican farmers initiative out of eastern Colorado. When I spoke at Walmart, I followed to the podium Jim Woolsey, ex-head of the CIA, who was talking about energy efficiency as a national security issue. Who said this? It's wrong, the pollution that you see. It's wrong, the smog that you see in cities. It's wrong putting chemicals into some river in a developing country so that people in a developed country can buy an item for less money. These things are just wrong, whether you're an environmentalist or not. Was that Dave Brower?
Richard Nixon.
No, as a matter of fact, it was Lee Scott, CEO of Walmart, the world's largest corporation. This is not a red or a blue issue. This is an issue of how can our companies be more profitable, how can our communities be more livable, how can we all be more secure, and how can we build a future that we can leave to our children with pride.
I got a nice email the other day from the Republicans for Environmental Protection, an organization down in Los Angeles. But that's just an example of if green becomes a true consumer-driven movement, it will go beyond politics.
The question?
Hello. I'd like to question the panel, and perhaps particularly Hunter Lovins, on what they think the role of government policy is in facilitating the transformation of large corporations, I'm thinking of the power industry, the auto industry, towards a more sustainable future, and taking cognizance of the fact that this can be hugely job-creating.
Yeah, we know a new study out of UC Berkeley, investing in renewable energy gives 10 times the jobs of investing in any of the fossil alternatives or in nuclear plants. Every big power plant you build, a nuke, for instance, loses the economy 4,000 net jobs because it's so capital intensive, it starves all other sectors. What's the role of government? We have been under a campaign of late to delegitimize government. It's like a bad light bulb joke. How many economists does it take to screw in a light bulb? None. The free market will do it. Well, go back and read Adam Smith. Markets allocate scarce resources efficiently in the short term. They were never intended to take care of grandchildren. They were never intended to be a religion. They were never intended to set policy about what kind of a future do we want. That's our job. That's the job of a free people coming together in a democracy. And we need, I think, to take back the role of government and the role of setting policy, of saying, what kind of a community do I want to live in? What kind of a world do I want to live in? And then getting involved. Democracy is a contact sport. If you don't enter the playing field, you're going to leave it to the people whose vested interest it is to be there. And if you then don't like the outcome, you've no one to blame but yourself. So let's all get involved.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind jumping on that one a little bit. I think, you know, we talk about change. You know, it's easier to die than it is to change. The government doesn't want to change. The corporations don't want to change. Nobody in this room really wants to change. So change isn't really anything that anybody wants to do or really embrace. And so to Hunter's point, what it's going to ultimately come down to is the people in this room. And it'll come through the things that you do at home. You know, I'm not going to ask for hands, but who actually owns a hybrid? You know, who doesn't turn on their heat at home and go out and buy the kids an extra set of sweats? You know, who's taking fashion? Who's doing all those little things that we all could be doing every single day? And if you're not doing that, I mean, it's great that you're here, and it's great that you're showing up and you're putting out support. But I think where it's going to show up is in the products you buy, because that'll be supporting the folks or the businesses that produce those products. And I think it's the people who you vote and put in office. I think ultimately we have the power. If we're really truly concerned about things, then it's we who will change it. Unfortunately, human nature, we tend to fight or flight. And so until somebody's probably in front of our homes with a bullhorn saying, don't leave your house today because you just can't breathe the air and strap on that oxygen tank, probably even then we're not going to really change. And it's a huge thing. I mean, there's a couple of issues in my mind that actually start to sort of blend together. There's the impact on just the planet itself, the carrying capacity of our world that we live in. That's one thing. And then there are just the whole global issues around warming and what we're actually doing to the planet. And then the third issue, which kind of gets pushed in here, is this whole oil dependency, which kind of does sort of relate but doesn't, but can, depending on what your audience is. So there's also a lot of information that, you know, is coming out that kind of overlaps, and it's a little bit confusing. And then who do you really trust and what's really going on? So at the end of the day, you know, I don't read the paper, and I don't really listen to the TV or the radio. You kind of got to take your own personal stand, and you've got to determine what the values are for you as a human being and as part of the human family. And I think that's where the change will come, is if we kind of care for each other and we care about the planet, then eventually things will probably happen. Now, I know for Hunter, that's going to take a lot longer than she would like to see, and certainly for anybody that's in business, it would, but, you know, it needs to be organic. It needs to come from the people for the planet. It needs to come from the employees for the organizations. It's a very tough road, but it's great forums like this that help further the cause.
Yeah, I think there are two ways in which we've become alienated that are absolutely critical to the solution. And one is that we have somehow convinced ourselves that we aren't government. And to say what's government's job, it really is what's our job. And that has been a degeneration in our society for a while, and that's got to stop. And then the other alienation is from nature. To pretend that nature isn't in this room with us right now is crazy. And we have essentially put nature out there, and I think that's also a root of the problem. We're with it. And yet we're not recognizing that, and we're not making the right kind of connections, especially kids. And Richard Louvre, in his book Last Child in the Woods, talks about nature deficit disorder. And I think as a society we're suffering from nature deficit disorder.
On the issue of governmental leadership, I think it's absolutely necessary. The government's going to have to lead us into the future. The market is primarily concerned with profits today, and I can speak that as a kind of red-blooded capitalist. And if I use our banking business model as a metaphor, when we loan money to you, and you, we expect you to pay it back, but also with interest. So if we look at what today's market is doing, it's we have borrowed as a society and as a market from our children. I have two small ones, ages 6 and 8, Sasha and Skylar. And I hope when my time has come, I'm going to pay them back with this place that they live, with both principal and interest. Make this place a little better. The market is only going to focus on the profit today. The government has to lead the market into investing for the future. And again, and Steve and Will's right, you guys and we are the government.
Question?
Hi, good evening, and thank you so much. This has been really informative. I was paying attention to your triple profit, triple P bottom line, and I feel like the people in that triple P you're talking to are the people who are most able to consume resources and who have the most access to those resources and products and services. And I was wondering what you're going to do or how you're going to bring up this dialogue and these services to people who have the least access, like people in West Oakland or Bayview's Hunters Point.
These issues are the same regardless of where you are, whether you're in Oakland or Hunters Point or Afghanistan, where I do a lot of work. Really, about the only way that people are going to be able to afford to development, to get development, to attain the legitimate quality of life that they're seeking is through creating real businesses that deliver basic human needs using world best practice in sustainable technologies. I do a lot of work in developing countries. I do a lot of work in developing communities. We have a product, again, that you can download from our website for free called LASER, Local Action for Sustainable Economic Renewal. And it begins with these same principles of how can you and your community create businesses and jobs around meeting your needs, identifying what your real capital is, and building upon that. I'd be happy to chat with you afterwards about how to go about doing this. But the basic principles are the same.
As an organization that's working in both Bayview Hunters Point and in Oakland, we recognize that the benefits of that connection with nature, of the outdoors, of a place for people to come together is something that everyone deserves to have. It's a fundamental right. Again, going back to the idea of sustainability, a city, a community is only as healthy as its most troubled neighborhood. And identifying where those issues are and addressing them directly is a fundamental responsibility of society, and it is part of the solution and part of the holistic solution. I don't think we get to solve any of these problems if we don't solve that problem.
Question?
Good evening. My name is Carol DiBenedetto. I'm with an organization called Global Footprint Network. We do a lot of around sustainability metrics, and you are all kind of senior members of the green movement. And I wonder where you are in thinking about metrics and comparability in your industries or your sectors or governments, just kind of generally what you're doing with that currently.
Well, I can tell you that internally we're in the process right now of measuring our own carbon footprint, and we do a lot of reforestation, we do sequestration work, et cetera, and we are trying to understand our impact through commuting. And you know, I'd be happy to cut down on my own personal air travel actually, anytime. So, I mean, that's one step that we can take and everyone should be doing, is to really understand, for starters, where that is. I think there's a whole lot that has to be done. In a way, it's the wild, wild west out there in terms of carbon and how you make those calculations, how you what truly sequesters, what truly matters. And I think we're all looking for more clarity. But in the meanwhile, understanding what your own either individual footprint is or organizational footprint is, and encouraging peer organizations to do the same thing is one way to go about it.
At Presidio, we have all of our students calculate their footprint, both using your metric and using the various carbon calculators, and it always comes as a serious shock to them to recognize that if everybody on Earth lived the way that they do, it would require 3 more, 5 more, 20 more Earths worth of resources. That's always sobering. So I think metrics are very important. Metrics are also important within a company. What are you measuring? Is it simply profit, or are you also measuring the social good that you're creating or the social harm that you're creating? And I would put a plea in for you guys to build a good social metric, because there doesn't exist one yet. There's several out there, and they give you the wrong answer. So we desperately need good social metrics. And your network is one of the best in the world at building these sorts of metrics.
We'll work on it.
I know at our place, we each of our hotels and restaurants has a pretty good idea of, you know, how much energy they're saving and how much water they're saving and how much pesticides they're not using and how many trees they haven't, you know, burnt and so on. And so, you know, we're able to come up with an aggregate for the company, but each business is so different in how they operate, it's hard to do it across the board. But we do measure it individually. What was clear with this program early on was that we needed to demonstrate wins early on to our employees and our management to get the support to continue to do more things and make the program bigger and deeper. And so, you know, demonstrating how many trees you save because of our whole company's on recycled paper, including the copy paper. We use soy ink, on and on. It resonated with the employees. On a bigger level, we're working with the team. In fact, the test that they're running, we're hoping they'll figure it out, because we want to use their formula to identify our impact. Geez, the amount of people we got traveling all over the place all the time, both from a home office and from an individual property level, you know, it's pretty huge. And I think you're right. I think we're going to get our minds blown when we see what the actual impact we're having. But then we're committed to either the carbon offset. I'm not so wild about the carbon offsets, although I somewhat believe that the money ends up in the right place. But I'm more about planting trees. So I'm working with these guys about getting my own forest, because I want to plant trees. But so we're newer in the metrics and what we can do about it, but we're clear that that's an inherent part of this process.
I used to work with tree people down in Southern California, and I've planted a lot of trees. I've got nothing against planting trees, but if you're serious about reducing your carbon footprint, you need to invest in something like Chicago Climate Exchange, which is an external third-party verified set of offsets, so you can have absolute confidence in where your money's going. And if, by the way, you do drive neutral or fly neutral, which we're now offering, the money goes through Chicago Climate Exchange, so you know exactly where it's going. The important thing, though, is that you invest in reducing direct combustion of carbon. We have 10 years to turn around climate change, folks. No kidding. This is an issue we've really got to get our heads around. So whatever it is that you do, invest in reducing direct emissions of carbon.
Right. On the metrics, I think we're definitely very open-minded, but until sort of methodologies are widely accepted, you know, there's a lot of room for common sense. When we build our green building to a LEED Gold standards, we kept track of the costs involved in doing that, and it was only 1% more than conventional. So that was important for us to tell that side of the story as well. And we haven't even begun to sort of look at the health benefits, since we were so new. But I know one of our employees have saved a lot of medication because she has chemical sensitivities. She was expecting to move into a new building and get a lot of allergic reactions. And when she walked in on the first day of occupancy, she didn't. We knew there were some savings there, so we're working to ask her how much, you know, allergy medication. Come back in a year, I'll have that number. But finally, I do have another position on the offsets, and I agree with Hunter that the best way to deal with it is not to generate in the first place. So we give our employees not money for offsets, but money to take public transit. So we pay for their public transit so they can take that bus that's already running near our building.
Thank you all so much. This has been a wonderful evening. Oh, and we have time for one more question. If there's one additional question from the audience. This gentleman right here in the, oh, go ahead. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi, my name is Max Mead. I work for a media company. We're producing a TV show called Building Green that'll start airing on PBS nationwide over the next couple months. So I've got another self-interested question here, but interested in hearing probably Peter and Steve specifically, what role does advertising and marketing and PR play in establishing your leadership in environmental responsibility and keeping that 16% number increasing rather than decreasing as people across the street start emulating all the hard work that you've invested
in. Sure.
Oh,
it's a big deal. We've never been a company, you won't like this maybe, but we've never been a company that's been big on advertising. In fact, we just don't advertise. The kinds of customers that seek and enjoy our product are not going to pick up on it from an ad. 60% of my business, 65% of my business comes from word of mouth referral. If I can get somebody into one of my hotels or restaurants, we're going to knock them out. We do a great job at what we do. We got great products in such a way that they're compelled to go out and tell other people about it. That's always been our primary focus. But we do try to reach out and let people know, and that's through public relations. And we've got four or five people full-time at the home office. I've got national and international firms. Each city where our hotels and restaurants are located have local firms. We're big believers in that. The amount of emails and letters and response that we get from our guests and our bookers of business is so huge that those are the kinds of things that we share through our PR effort. Our company will never be the biggest and the most well-known, but our goal is to be the best loved by the people who do business with us. And that's the mission that we're on. So our marketing and our focus is very internal. It's very focused on our employees. Employees are the heart and soul of the organization, not the management. We get that. And our guests. And that's where I put, if I have money for any kind of external promotion, I put it into some kind of guest service or guest experience.
I also agree. Notoriety certainly doesn't equal leadership. So I would be the first one to admit that just being in Time Magazine doesn't make me an environmental leader. So I'm far from it. But the authenticity of the brand is the most critical part. So if you advertise and you don't have that authenticity, and as Hunter pointed out, maybe there lies the two-edged sword of eco-imagination. At the same time, if the advertising help carries the right message and the right authenticity of the brand, it could certainly work. But we're also looking at a world that's now, in the Web 2.0 space. And I'll give you one example. To us, ultimately, it comes back to the old-fashioned, your customer is your best salespeople. And for us, nothing works better than our customer testimonial. We're very fortunate that almost every one of our customers, in fact, not almost, every one of our customers wants to be our reference. One of my colleagues here, Charlotte, sitting in the front here, helped a young man open his account. And the next thing we knew, he was blogging very positively about us, and especially about the organic apple I gave him while he was opening that account. So clearly, the advertising if you have an established brand, can help refresh and redirect it. If you have a new brand, you must establish, the true identity of it before advertising can work for you.
There's a real difference between advertising and marketing. Dr. Ron Naser, who is the provost at Presidio School of Management, will tell you that marketing lies at the heart of strategy. Marketing is understanding your market. And in an internet-empowered world, if people don't like what you do, and they will know, they won't buy from you. So marketing is understanding what it is that people out there want. When I was at Walmart, the marketing guys stood up and started talking about how they had studied the Walmart demographic. Yeah, you better believe they have. They have understood that it is disproportionately female, and they have surveyed these people who have said that they want sustainability. And these marketers came to report to the company that there's a very high correlation between their demographic and desire for sustainability. They are rebranding the company as affordable sustainability. We haven't seen anything yet. This movement is just poised to take off. So hang on to your hats.
That's wonderful. Thank you all so much for joining us. Please join me in thanking our speakers, Steve Panetti, Will Rogers, Hunter Lovins, and Peter Liu. I also want to thank our audience here for attending and our radio audience as well. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.